This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest Ian McLagan may not be a household name, but chances are pretty good you've heard his keyboards. McLagan was among the first generation of British rockers and had a long career playing and recording with Rod Stewart, the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, and others. He now lives in Austin, Texas, recording and playing at local clubs and touring with his group, The Bump Band. The band has a new CD, which is dedicated to the memory of McLagan's wife, Kim, who died in an auto accident in 2006. Critic Dennis Cook called the album a bittersweet joy, full of ghosts and longing, but also the great passion of the living. Here's the title track, Never Say Never.
I can feel your touch on my face. I remember kissing you for the first time. I can sense you just out of frame. And I'll be reminiscing for the rest of my life. Never loved anyone. I never loved anybody. But you, baby, never been lucky, baby, never back winners, but I never say never again.
That's Never Say Never, the title track from the Bump Band's new album. I spoke with Ian McLagan in 2004 about his memoir, All the Rage, which describes his first four decades in rock, using drugs, shagging groupies, and trashing hotel rooms. McLagan spent years playing with Rod Stewart's band, Faces. Here's Faces' only hit in the U.S., Stay With Me.
McLagan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave. Nice to be talking to you.
You came of age at a time in the mid-60s that was really the dawn of British rock and roll and had been doing music all these years. When you were a teenager in the early 60s and just scratching around in the music business, and it was a time when British rock was really just taking form. I mean, the Beatles and the Stones and the Who were all just getting going. And give us a sense of what the scene was like. I mean, were you aware that something kind of new and different, exciting was happening?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was in the air. You know, I loved the Stones. I used to see them every Sunday after I discovered them, you know, and then I'd follow them. I'd catch them on a Wednesday somewhere else, you know, and then I'd find they were playing somewhere else on a Saturday night, and I'd go there. And then when The Who came out, I met Pete very early on at Jim Marshall's drum shop, as it was, before he made guitar amps. I met Mitch Mitchell. He used to serve behind the counter there. He was later ended up as drummer with Jimi Hendrix, of course. And there was a buzz going on. And Townsend was like, first time I met him, he said, "So how you doing? What's your band?" He was all interested in what I was doing. I was interested in what he was doing, and you know, we'd all heard the music, you know, and we wanted to play it. And then the next thing was to try and get gigs. And then, you know, I became manager and a kind of agent of my band, although I wasn't the singer. I was just the rhythm keyboard player. But it was very exciting. You just constantly trying to get gigs and plan and find out where the clubs were and checking other bands out and thinking, they ain't that good, we're better than them, you know. It was, I was too committed to know that, you know, I was just having the best time.
You were listening to a lot of American blues. Were a lot of British teenagers into that then? I mean, I don't think American kids were so much. Where did you get the records?
Well, they were difficult to find. You know, the thing is, one night, Humphrey Lyttelton had a jazz program. I think it was a Monday night on radio. What was BBC One, I suppose it was then. And he played Muddy Waters live at Newport, Hoochie Coochie Man. And that pretty much changed my life. That album, which I eventually bought with great difficulty from the local record store in Hounslow where I lived, that and Thelonious Monk, Monk's Moods, just changed my life. And I figured, well, Monk's a great blues player, and whoever is playing with Muddy is a great blues player. That was, of course, Otis Spann. And Otis is probably my main influence on the piano, you know.
So you're with the Mule Skinners. They split up, and you find yourself bandless and then get recruited to an established group with a record contract, right? Small Faces.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, strangely, I was in another band in between, and but they weren't that keen to work, and the van broke down one night, and they kind of laughed, and we were supposed to be going up to Scotland, which is, you know, like 6 or 7 hour drive back then before the motorways, you know. And so we set up again, off again the next night and next afternoon, and the van broke down again. I said, that's it, I quit. And so I was depressed, and I went to see my girlfriend that night. And on the way back, I bumped into a friend of mine, Phil, who said, so how's the band? I said, oh, I just left. And he said, oh, you should join the Small Faces. I said, oh, yeah, that's very funny, Phil. I thought, sarcastic. And the next morning, their manager called me, and that afternoon I joined the band.
Was that just a coincidence?
Yeah.
Amazing.
They'd had that one hit, you see, and I'd seen them on television, and my dad said, check this band out, they're great. And I looked at them, I thought, boy, they're great. They're a great singer, and they look great. Well, that's the sort of band I'd like to be in, you know. And within you know, a few months, I was a member. It felt like I was just plucked out of nowhere.
The group had a certain visual style. What did you look like?
Oh, we were pretty sharp. I mean, apart from anything, we were all the same height. None of us were over 5'6".
Thus the Small Faces.
Yes, but although the guy I replaced was taller, and that wasn't why they threw him out. He just wasn't much of an organ player. But they read a review of the band I was in previously, and they quoted me as saying, they quoted the reviewer said that I played really good, but they had a photo of the lead singer who was much handsomer than me, and they thought, well, he's obviously a great player and he looks great, let's get him. And when they met me, they were a bit surprised by the change in face. But I was the right size.
Your big hit in America with Small Faces was Ichiku Park, and maybe we should hear that. Tell us about that song.
Well, strangely enough, Steve Marriott and Ronnie Lane wrote together, and it was hard to break into that partnership, although occasionally I would write with kind of a little germ of mine that Ronnie would help, and then that would come out as Marriott Lane McLagan. I could never just separate them. But in fact, I didn't realize that Ronnie Lane wrote that song, almost as one of his. You know, the way a partnership works, it's one or the other mainly, and the other one helps. Well, that was a Ronnie Lane composition. And years later, when I was living in L.A., he called me from Austin in 1990 and asked if I would tour Japan with him. And I said, I'd love to. I said, just one thing, Ronnie. He said, what's that? I said, let's not do Ichiku Park. I said, I'm sick of that song. He said, but, Mac, I wrote that. I said, I'm sorry, I hate it.
Do you really hate the song?
Yeah. Well, see, I don't think it is all too beautiful. I'm a lucky guy. I'm a happy guy, but I don't think it's all too beautiful.
Not so much like what most of the music you were doing.
Right.
Well, with apologies to our guest, Ian McLagan, let's hear Ichiku Park from Small Faces.
Over bridge of sights, to rest my eyes in shades of green, under dreaming spots, to Ichiku Park, that's where I've been. What did you do there?
I got high.
What did you feel there?
Well, I cried.
What were the tears there?
Tell you why, it's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful.
I feel inclined to blow my mind. Guitar, feed the ducks with a bun. They all come out to groove about, be nice and have fun in the sun.
That was Ichiku Park by Small Faces. On keyboards was my guest, Ian McLagan. Ichiku Park is, it's a song that's sort of more in the psychedelic vein, rather than the blues that you were playing. Is that what you don't like about it?
Well, it was, yes, but it's that, you know, we were, Ronnie Steve and I took acid in 1966 and took acid again the next week and took a lot of acid over a period of time, and the music did change, and I think in some ways for the worse. I mean, it's like movies made around that time. Some of them are so hopeless. I can't look at them now. They're just so desperately trying to prove that they've taken acid, you know. And it's all too beautiful was the chorus of Ichiku Park, and it's that whole thing, you know. I don't think you have to prove it. You know, the experience was pleasant, and now let's move on. Let's go back to what we were doing. But we never did, really.
It's also remarkable that you were in a band that had a lot of hits. I mean, you 14 hits in the UK, if I remember. And yet, you didn't make any money. You couldn't even afford your own apartments for a long time. Why?
We had management. We had very good management, or should we say thieves. We were just unlucky in that way. I mean, we were enjoying ourselves, you know, making the music and touring, but we never actually managed to get any royalties publishing or any money from the gigs. We were paid a wage of £20 a week, and that's pretty much, we had our we were living in a house together at that time. That was paid, and our food was paid, and our clothes were paid, and that was about it. That's all we got out of it.
You were awfully young. I mean, you were, what, 20, 21, and some of the guys were younger.
I was the oldest, yeah, and Kenny was 16. Yeah, I mean, we were ignorant about business. I mean, boy. And, I mean, we were so thrilled to be able to, you know, play music, really, and that it never occurred to us. We never had a bank account, and our parents kind of suspected it and went to have a meeting with our manager, Don Arden, and he threw a red herring in front of me. He said, people in show business spend money, and they spent theirs, and anyway, they're on drugs. And the parents then just left the office so downhearted, you know. And of course, we weren't on drugs. We were smoking pot.
Right.
You know.
It was suggested that
the suggestion was, or what they thought was, that we were on heroin or something, you know. That was the end of the inquiry into where the money was, you know.
And you were generating a fortune for them, right?
Well, yeah, we were. Well, we were then on £50 a week, so I suppose that was some improvement. We still didn't get record royalties. In fact, we didn't get record royalties from Immediate till 1997, and from Decca Records, which was the earlier period, till 1991, I think it was.
My guest is musician Ian McLagan. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is keyboard player and singer Ian McLagan. His group, The Bump Band, has a new CD called Never Say Never. Well, Ian McLagan, we were talking about your association with the group Small Faces, which split up when its lead singer, Steve Marriott, decided to leave and join Peter Frampton in a group, Humble Pie. And then you recombined and formed the group Faces. You had four albums and a lot of hits. You toured in the States. Let's listen to a track. I thought we would listen to You're So Rude, which is a song you collaborated on with the late Ronnie Lane. You want to say a word about this, Tim?
Yes. I only wrote one song with Ronnie, actually, in all the years we were together. And he came over to my house, and I had a beautiful harmonium, a pump organ, in my in the hallway of the house, because I was having work done on the studio and I couldn't get it in there at that moment. So it was, you had to kind of squeeze past it. And he said, "Oh, that's nice." I said, "Yeah, listen to how it played." And I played him something I'd written on the harmonium. And he sat down and he wrote the lyrics to You're So Rude in about 10 minutes flat. And it was a true story how he and his girlfriend were caught at it. He suggests that he'll wet his socks, pretend he just got caught in the rain. Anyway, it's a true story.
Okay, so let's listen to You're So Rude. This is the group Faces. It was originally recorded on A Nod Is As Good As a Wink and is on the new 4-CD box set.
My mom, she likes you. She thinks you're swell. Got the makings of a dance hall girl. Your low-cut frock and your bird's nest hair. Still at her heels and the way that you swear. She said to take you back to see my folks again. On Sunday. Why, it looks as though there's nobody in. They've all gone out to see my
That was You're So Rude from the group Faces. It's included on the new CD box set produced by our guest, Ian McLagan, who played keyboards. You know, one of the things that I like about that track, apart from the organ that you play at the top, is that it is not Rod Stewart on the vocal, who people have long associated with Faces, but Ronnie Lane, the late Ronnie Lane, the bass player. He gives a great delivery there, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. I mean, it's tongue in cheek. You know, you can hear his smile. You know, he was a very cheeky boy, Ronnie. And I met the girl in question, funny enough, previously. I'd met her when we were in Small Faces together. But he was the most prolific writer with the Faces and Small Faces. And I figured this box set should honour him as much as anything, because he's not around, he's not here to be honoured in person, and he's very much loved by all who knew him and know him or know his music. And so the album, the box set is dedicated to Ronnie.
You played with Bonnie Raitt and a whole lot of other artists. I mean, you became a fairly sought-after session musician, I guess. You declined a chance to play with the Grateful Dead. Why was that?
Well, I didn't actually decline the chance. Yes, it was a chance. I wasn't given the gig. A friend of mine, who was a friend of Jerry Garcia's, said they're looking for their current keyboard player has died, and they're looking for someone else. He said they want you to play to a tape and submit it, you know. And he said, you'd make a quarter of a million a year, you know. You could live anywhere you want, blah, blah, blah. And I was actually on vacation at the time in San Diego with my wife and our dogs. And I went out and bought a Grateful Dead CD. And my wife went out to do some shopping and came back to the hotel room. And I was sitting in a blue funk in a brown study in a green swarm of hell. And she said, what's the matter? I said, I can't play this music. It sucks. I mean, just my personal taste. I didn't understand it, didn't get it. You know, still don't really. I mean, I know they make a lot of money. They got lots of fans. I'm sorry if I've upset anyone, but, you know.
Wasn't your cup of tea.
Wasn't my cup of tea. No more than Fish. All that jam band. That's so tediously boring. But, you know, I like a tune. I like a tune and a singer and a solo, and now more of the tune. Yeah, I just couldn't even do it, you know.
Ian McLagan recorded in 2004. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. McLagan's current group, The Bump Band, has a new album called Never Say Never, and they'll start an 8-city tour on April 28th. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. We're listening to my interview recorded in 2004 with veteran British rocker Ian McLagan. He played for years with the group Faces and wrote a memoir called All the Rage. His current group, The Bump Band, has a new album called Never Say Never. Well, Ian McLagan, when Faces split up, you were known in the music business. You'd stayed in touch with the Stones, with Mick Jagger, with Keith Richards, and they eventually invited you to collaborate on a recording session and go on tour. What was that like?
Well, actually, when the album came out, which was Some Girls, and I'd played on Miss You and Just My Imagination, when they started to tour, getting ready to tour in 78, Keith asked me if I would tour with them. I said, boy, yeah. And I jumped on a plane and toured with them, and then stayed in America. Well, I went back to England, but then we moved straight after that. I just, I liked America at that time. England was, there was nothing going on for me, you know.
You know, I read in your book that you played on those recording sessions for the Stones track, Some Girls, and shocked to discover that they never paid you for that session.
Well, they did, but, you know, I mean, I was there as a guest. You know, I mean, I was, you know, I wasn't really, I hadn't been hired. I was there to socialize, really. But I said to Mick, is there any chance of any cash? And I think he gave me the equivalent. I was either 120 francs or 120 pounds. Didn't really pay for my cab fare, but...
Well, so you eventually end up touring with the Stones, which must have been a thrill. I mean, you admired them all these years.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you had a couple of awkward moments with Mick Jagger where he talked to you about payment, what you wanted to get paid, right?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Guys were multimillionaires at this point, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, this was at the end of the tour. They wanted to record in L.A., and so I hung on there for a couple of weeks while we waited to get in the studio, and Mick had a conversation with me about money over a game of pool. And he's not really a drinker, Mick, you know, and I am a professional drinker. And so we had a beer together, and the reason he came over to the house was to discuss business, and I didn't know. I just thought he wanted a game of pool. Well, he got more and more drunk, and he said, so how much do you want? And I said, well, how long do you want to record? And he said, 2 weeks. I said, 15 grand. And he said, I'm not paying you 50. He thought I'd said 50 instead of 15. He said, I'll give you 20, and that's the end of it. And I said, okay. Well, of course, the next day, he completely forgot about this conversation. And then, you know, we screwed around for several days with his employees as to, you know, deciding on what I'd be paid. And eventually, I did get my 15, but not after a lot of argument.
A lot of the guys that you shared, you know, a touring, recording, and performing life with, I mean, Ron went on to some pretty remarkable things. I mean, Ron Wood still plays with the Stones. Rod Stewart, you know, does his thing out there and plays at arenas. I mean, you do music, but at a sort of a more modest scale there in Austin. And I'm kind of wondering, do you like it better that way, or do you wish you were out there in front of these huge crowds doing it differently?
It's such a good question. You know, when I first joined the Small Faces, I was so happy because, as I said, I was playing every night, playing with people who wanted to play. And we'd play after gigs. We'd just play, you know, in a hotel room. We'd just, like, be playing and talking, listening to music. Well, I did an interview for a magazine called Beat Instrumental, which was about gigs and musicians, and, you know, in the current scene, back in 65. And they asked me, what did I see in the future, you know? And it's amazing what you say sometimes. And I actually said this. I said, I picture myself in a smoky club playing rhythm and blues. Well, hello. It came true, and I shouldn't complain because I love it still. I just wish I could make more money at it. But it's what I love to do.
You fell in love with the Hammond organ. In fact, there was one point when the Faces broke up that you went across continents trying to retrieve one you had. Are they still around? I mean, can you still find and play a Hammond?
Yeah, actually, they're to be found in a lot of churches. And sadly, when a church, for whatever reason, goes downhill, they sell their Hammonds or other organs, and they're often in perfect condition because they've never traveled. You know, my I call her Betty, but I've had her since 1969. That's what you hear on Maggie May and on All the Faces stuff, and that's what you hear in all my records. She's been with me all that time, and she's really too... I mean, she's been around the world a few times. She's been beaten up and, you know, she's been damaged a little bit, more than some Holiday Inn rooms. But you can still find them. I found a beautiful one in 1994 or 93 for $500. She's my pride and joy. She's in my studio at home and will never tour.
Well, do you play Betty because of the sentimental attachment, or does she have a sound that you just can't get anywhere else?
Well, I've worked on her. I mean, over the years, she's a bit of a hybrid. She's a racehorse, you know, not just a plow horse. She's built for speed and built for sound, built for volume. She can, you know, electric guitarists like to think they're loud. You know, they can't top me. I can finally compete.
Well, Ian McLagan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Dave, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Ian McLagan recorded in 2004. His current group, The Bump Band, has a new album called Never Say Never. Comic, actor, and writer Dennis Leary first became known for his short, corrosive, satirical bits on MTV. Now he's co-creator, executive producer, co-writer, and star of the series Rescue Me. The fifth season has just premiered on FX. Leary plays Tommy Gavin, a New York City firefighter who's constantly risking his life to save others, but constantly letting down his friends and family and getting into fights. In this scene from next week's episode, he's facing expulsion from the fire department because of his reckless behavior, and he's sent to meet with the department shrink.
Let's see what we got here. You dress up in your dead cousin's gear and go out on calls with your crew and the crew on another shift. You'd hide in the truck and you'd go out on calls as your dead cousin. This dead cousin thing, what is up with that?
After 9/11, it's kind of complicated, but basically, in a nutshell, had some problems with my wife, drinking pills, a lot of drinking, and my brother and my wife had an affair. And but he's dead now. So, and then I quit drinking and the pills and everything. So,
okay, get out of here.
I didn't kill him.
Yeah.
My brother.
It's okay. Go.
You know, guys like you, yeah. You know, you just. I get what, 4 seconds to explain myself? I've been fighting fires.
Mr. Gavin, go back to work. You're cleared. Case dismissed.
Go back to the firehouse?
Look, Mr. Gavin, you're a vet. You've got all the years, the saves, the mental recommendations.
That's right.
Whack job or not. The department can't afford to lose guys like you. Maybe you're a little nuts, yeah, but all the guys we lost in the towers, all the guys who got out after, you know, there's just too much fresh blood on the job right now. We need you.
Well, thank you. So I'm not crazy.
Oh, you're crazy. You're like Margot Kidder hiding in the bushes. Kind of crazy, but you know, your job is to run at the fire. You got to be a little crazy, right? Right.
Dennis Leary also has a book released last year called Why We Suck, and he's on a new comedy tour. Terry spoke to Dennis Leary in 2007.
Dennis Leary, welcome back to Fresh Air. Rescue Me was inspired by a couple of firefighters you were close to. Would you tell us something about them?
One is the technical advisor to Rescue Me, an old friend of mine named Terry Quinn, who's been a New York City firefighter for 20-some-odd years now. And he is one of my oldest friends and, much like Tommy Gavin, has no interest in becoming an officer or anything other than a truck guy, which means the guys who actually, you know, run off into the fire, you know, when they jump off the rig at an event. He's an action guy. So he's also our technical advisor in charge of all of our big fire scenes. And the other guy, who shall remain nameless, who's a good friend of mine as well, whenever I see him, whatever he's talking about in terms of his personal life becomes fodder for the upcoming episodes of Rescue Me, because he lives such a rich and interesting life. Then two of those guys combined are who Tommy Gavin is. He's just lives and dies to fight fires.
You have a cousin who was killed in a fire.
Yeah. And
do you think he ever thought that that would happen to him?
He used to say, when his wife or his mother or anybody would say, you know, what are we going to do if something happens to you? Because he was considered a quote-unquote fireman's fireman. Like, he was the first guy in. The night that he died, he was filling in for a guy who had done a favor for him, and he was supposed to be driving the truck, but he hated staying with the truck while guys went into a fire. So he traded off with another guy who said, you know, I don't want to sit with the truck if something happens tonight. I want to be in the building. So he wasn't supposed to be working that night, and he wasn't supposed to be actually going into the building, but he was, because that's where he wanted to be. He was looking for two homeless people. He used to say, you guys are just going to have to deal with it if I get killed. See, the amazing part of that story with my cousin is not just that he went into a burning, you know, inferno of a cold storage warehouse building that the windows had been bricked up. He went in looking for two homeless people. He got trapped with another guy. The kid that I grew up with, that we grew up with, named Tommy Spencer, who was outside when they closed the building down. The chief said, nobody else is going in. It's too big. It was shutting the building down. Tommy Spencer tied three other guys to himself, and he walked up to the chief, who was blocking the doorway, and said, get out of the way or I'll knock you down. I'm going in to get Paul and Jerry. And they went in, and within, you know, minutes, the building went up a second time. That is an amazing amount of courage, and the sense of brotherhood, and just to begin with, the sense of brotherhood towards your fellow man, two homeless people that you don't even know, and then the sense of, well, we know this is probably not going to work, but we have to make that last stand to see if we can get those guys out.
I'd imagine that, you know, starring in, doing some of the writing, and of course also producing the series Rescue Me, has you thinking a lot about death and about kind of self-destructive impulses, because like your character Tommy, he deals with life and death every day in putting himself in life-threatening situations to rescue people. At the same time, he flirts with death through smoking and alcohol and really stupid risks he takes in his personal life.
Yeah. I think part of the attraction to writing these guys was the male ego, as it exists in almost every man, and then the male ego as required for the type of courage that this job takes. One of the things that the male ego does when mortality bumps up against it is you want to have sex. You want to prove, I'm vital, I'm alive. Look at me, I'm alive. And these guys are living this crazy job that has everything to do with life and death, but nothing to do with life as we know it, love, death, and taxes, you know, the way we look at it. So that's where I find it to be very rich, and it never ceases to amaze me, the stories. Like, a buddy of mine told me a story today. He was a firefighter. He was at work. He got a phone call from his brother, and his brother said, I got some bad news. And he said, what is it? He said, Dad died. He said, when? Like, about 5 minutes ago. And he said, all right. And he went back into the bunk room. He fell asleep. The alarm went off an hour later. He went to a fire. He never dealt with his father's death because he dealt with death. And then one day, he was reading Flags of Our Fathers last year, and he collapsed for 2 days and basically couldn't stop crying. You know, 10 years after his father had died, because he's so afraid of letting the other emotions about the girl that he didn't save here, the guys that came out of 9/11 like him, and the guys who didn't, guys that he knew and loved, and so many emotions that they're like, you have to be an animal, you have to be like a shark, you have to keep moving forward. Yeah, everything's behind me, everything's behind me, everything's behind me. That's an interesting story. I mean, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to Tommy Gavin when he stops moving?
Yeah, here's this character, you know, who's really attracted to extremes, you know, so like, you know, rescuing people and fighting fires and stuff, but those extremes don't match in, say, being life as a spouse or as a father, and he has real trouble in those areas.
Yeah, and most of the guys that I know, even the guys that this character's based on, have those same issues. But you know what? If you asked them, if you cornered them, you wouldn't even have to corner them. You could just ask them. they'll say that's what makes them a great firefighter. One of the things they talk about, women compartmentalizing emotions and approaches and how they live. And that's one of the things about, like, even my cousin Jerry, he knew that there was a chance every time he was, you know, at work that he wasn't going to come back. And he was okay with that, even though he loved his kids and his wife. And his wife understood when she met him that that's what he wanted to be. He knew that was a box in his head, that this is always a possibility and it doesn't matter. I still will take the chance. It's like rolling the dice, you know?
Has it been, like, oddly therapeutic to write your character of Tommy in Rescue Me? Because he has so many of the extremes of the male ego that you've written about, and probably some of which you've had, and probably some of which you've tried to, like, undo. But, like, by putting all of these extremes, you know, like the fighting, the drinking, inability to have really enduring emotional relationships.
Yes.
So by putting that in him, can you stand back and say, I see what the problem is?
Well, it has helped me, definitely. It has helped me, certainly, in terms of grief. I lost so many people in such a short period of time, from the time my cousin was killed in that fire through 9/11, and then one of my best friends on the planet, Ted Demme, dropped dead January of 2002, right after 9/11. It helps in that regard. It does. What's good is that the two guys I said that I based the character on are like my same age, and I was talking to one of them this morning just about some very, very personal stuff, and the two of us were comparing notes on stupid things that we've done in relationships and talking about our kids and raising our kids. And the good thing is that at this age, we're starting to realize what idiots we have been and are potentially capable of being again. And I think that's a thing that I was never a part of my father's generation of men. Like, even me, I'm talking to this really tough, great New York City firefighter, and he's telling me things. It's like I'm talking to my shrink. And he's telling me things that that are ringing bells in my head, and I'm going, you're right. We do need to be more emotionally available for the women in our lives and for our daughters and for our sons. And then I hear an alarm go off because he's at the firehouse. He's like, I'll call you back later. And he's going out on the call. So there's hope that we as men, that we will actually – I can't believe I'm 50 and just learning a lot of the stuff that I'm learning. I mean, I look back and I think, what a moron I was. I mean – What did I think?
Give me an example.
Give you an example. A year ago, I got into a fight with a cab driver. It was just ridiculous downtown, which ended up with nothing except him locking himself in the car and me trying to get in, and then me realizing that there are people with camera phones and that I've achieved nothing except if I wasn't in shape, I'd probably have a heart attack. And then I was late for work. So I drove away going, now what did I gain there? My face is red. My blood pressure is high. My heart's racing. I'm angry as hell. And all I've got is a bruise on my hand and nothing else.
What was the fight with the taxi cab driver about?
All right. So now you want to get to the core of the male ego?
Yes.
I'm on my way to work. I'm driving. It's early, early in the morning. I'm driving to the set of Rescue Me. And, you know, this is why they really don't allow me to drive myself to work anymore, by the way. I'm driving myself to work, and there's nothing but green lights in front of us because there's no traffic. It's like, you know, it's 5:45 or something in the morning. And he's strolling along at like 10 miles an hour. He's looking to find a fare. And I beep the horn because we got four green lights in front of us. And he short brakes me. He puts the brake on. I just miss hitting his back end. Then he speeds up to the next, it's still a green light, the next block. And I come up behind him and he short brakes me again. So I squeal to a stop and he goes a third time. Well, the third time, I'm not proud to say it, but it was, I think, any jury of my peers would be on my side, you know, like 12 Dennis Learys. I hit him. I tapped him from behind. And, of course, we both got out. And he started screaming, and half English, half Pakistani, because he's not an American citizen. That's why I started. I was like, get your license and registration. That's when he panicked, because he didn't have one because he's not a citizen of this country. So he locks himself in the cab. And I'm ranting and raving and holding up my wallet and my license registration, you know, wearing a 62 truck Rescue Me t-shirt. You know, could I have more of an advertisement? Like, I wonder who that is. So, and it went on for like 15, 20 minutes. It's stupid. It's so stupid. And by the way, thank God my kids weren't with me so they could see how what an example their dad is for yelling and screaming at a guy who can't even understand English, you know. But I was in the right. See, there's the male ego part. I was right because there were green lights and he was, it's stupid.
Well, Dennis Leary, I wish you good luck in being mature. And it was great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye.
Dennis Leary and Terry Gross recorded in 2007. The fifth season of Leary's series Rescue Me premiered on FX this week. Seth Rogen is starring in yet another new movie. It's called Observe and Report, and it's by North Carolina-born writer-director Jody Hill, who had a cult hit in 2006 with the comedy The Foot Fist Way. He then went on to co-create the HBO series Eastbound and Down with its star Danny McBride. In Hill's second feature, Rogen plays a mall security guard who takes his job a little too seriously. The film co-stars Anna Faris and Ray Liotta. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Gonzo gun humor might not be what we're in the mood for after last week's spate of shootings, but Jody Hill's Observe and Report isn't just mindless fun with weaponry. About a half step below the surface, it's scary as hell. It's the taxi driver of satirical farces. In Martin Scorsese's explosive drama, Robert De Niro's Travis Bickle was a sponge for all the bad vibes of New York City in the 1970s. He obsessed over a blonde who was out of his league, and then he went nuts and assumed the role of vigilante avenger. In Observe and Report, we have Seth Rogen's head of mall security, Ronnie Barnhart. He soaks up all suburbia's bad vibes, obsesses over a blonde who's out of his league, and then goes nuts and assumes the role of vigilante avenger. We laugh at this gun-toting savior in his own mind, but he's too out of control for comfort. The movie opens with an overweight man rushing up to women in the mall parking lot, spreading his raincoat and gleefully showing off his family jewels. A short time later, Rogan's Ronnie, now on the hunt for the flasher, says to himself, "Part of me thinks this disgusting pervert is the best thing that ever happened to me." Of course, the creep is virtually Ronnie's doppelganger. He's not only given Ronnie's life a focus, he's given him license to show off his own family jewels, metaphorically. The night after the flasher has accosted Brandy, the lissom blonde cosmetics clerk played by Anna Faris, Ronnie takes advantage of the opening to scoop her up in his security golf cart and press his case.
Brandy! Brandy, Brandy, Brandy. Okay, Brandy, I'm going to lay out a scenario for you. You, me, free dinner. You fill in the rest with the answer yes.
There's my car.
Huh? What?
Where are you going?
What? Sorry, the brakes. Or someone cut the brakes.
Oh, my God!
I can't stop! I'm just joking. I can't stop, but I'm not going to unless you agree to go to dinner with me. Someone better say yes and tell me what they want to eat for dinner.
Fine.
It's a date.
Just don't tell anybody.
It can't be overemphasized. Ronnie is in the top tier of unattractive heroes. Whether he's putting unwanted moves on Brandy, harassing a Muslim lotion vendor, tasering people who park in loading docks, or interfering with the detective played by Ray Liotta, who's investigating both the flasher and a series of mall robberies. In Observe and Report, Director Hill piles on unpleasantries as if testing our need to identify with the man with the gun, or taser. Hill seems genuinely fascinated by mini-despots. His first comedy, The Foot Fist Way, focused on a bullying martial arts instructor played by Danny McBride. It was only after this peewee authoritarian was thoroughly humiliated by bigger authoritarians that we began to sympathize with him. This macho blowhard was in some ways a casualty of a macho blowhard culture. Observe and Report's Ronnie is a casualty too. He's never known his father, and his loving mother is prodigiously drunk. He's on strong psychoactive medication. He lives in a world that prizes guns and the people who use them. He works in a mall and eats fast food every day at the food court. It's amazing he's as functional as he is. Hill hits what seems like a bad taste peak early on, a scene in which Ronnie takes advantage of an ostensibly unconscious alcohol and drug-addled vomit-flecked Brandy and just keeps climbing. When Ronnie and the number two security guard, played by Michael Peña, embark on an orgy of drug-taking and authoritarian violence against unarmed civilians, the air in the theater feels dangerously thin. This is comedy? It is with this cast, all of them near geniuses. Anna Faris draws out her words as if hysterically entranced by her own blondness. Her hyperventilations are exquisite. Leota uses that eerie tension between his teenage delinquent complexion and girlish eyes to make you laugh before he opens his mouth. And Rogan, even if he is in every other movie these days, still has surprises in him. The only reason there's no body count here is because Observe and Report is, when all is said and done, a comedy. But what a comedy. Behind that bland, neutral title is a mighty volcano of psychosexual mayhem, a carnival funhouse mirror of our culture's love affair with violence.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hertzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.